Philosophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?
It is time for Too Wretched for Radio with Phil Johnson. Phil, I've got a question for you about your office. How many books are in your library shelves?
You know, I don't know. I've never counted them. I'll say, though, that they surround me. There are books floor to ceiling in shelves on all four sides of my desk.
Well, I'm hoping you've got room for a few more. I'd like to share with you some books that I'm sure you're going to want to gobble up and put right there behind you, so when you have guests, they look at your book collection right behind your head when they're talking to you.
I cannot wait.
Which, by the way, isn't that true? Anytime I visit a pastor's office, my eyes are just immediately,
yeah.
Okay, whose commentary is that? Where? And then there's inevitably a heresy shelf,
yeah,
where the good guys, they'll put the bad guys. So it's like, look, just so you don't think that I'm into the purpose-driven church, I've got it down on this shelf right here. I love that.
Now, you've never actually seen my office. You've never been here, but you've just described it perfectly.
I haven't been invited.
Oh, you're invited. There's an open invitation for you anytime you want to come. I would love to take...
You're just saying that so you can get the money I owe you. Okay, here we go. Here are the books from IVP Academic.
Uh-oh.
InterVarsity Press. This is an academic book. The title is, Can White People Be Saved? And wow. White, by the way, is in quotation marks. What? Triangulating Race, Theology, and Mission. Can you judge this book by its cover, Phil?
Well, you can't judge any book solely by its cover, usually. I mean, unless it's...
I can.
Well, occasionally.
That's one of my spiritual giftings.
But yeah. No, I mean, that's not sufficient for me to judge it on. I it's the kind of thing, if I were in a bookstore and saw that, I'd pick it up, flip through it, try to see, you know, where's this guy coming from? Maybe he's just using a provocative title to sort of challenge some of the... radical leftist ideology about race and race relations that's leaking into the evangelical movement. But since it comes from IVP, that really isn't their trajectory. So I'm assuming it's going to be one of those that actually borrows radical leftist race theology from the secular academic world and regurgitates it on a level that typical evangelical millennial people will read and think it's profound and important, and books like that are not my favorite. So no, it's probably not a book I would buy.
All right, let me share with you the details. This is from Ivy Press, so this is their press release on it. Quote, no one is born white.
That is true. We're all different shades of color. I'm not white.
Well, true, but if you look at the color wheel, there's all kinds of shades of white, but I don't get there. No one is born white.
I'm more pink.
While there is no biological basis for a white race, whiteness is real. What's more, whiteness as a way of being in the world has been parasitically joined to Christianity. And this is the ground of many of our problems today. It is time to redouble the efforts of the church and its institutions to muster well-informed, gospel-based initiatives to fight racialized injustice and overcome the heresy of whiteness. I think we're getting a clue, Phil.
The heresy of whiteness, huh? No, I get this, and I have heard the arguments, and I think there actually is a very small segment, and it used to be bigger, in fairness, I think, of... sort of ultra-white, white supremacist Christianity. And that's probably what they're going to highlight and argue against and all that. My response to a book like that, is that really a rising threat today, or does the threat not actually come from a totally different direction? And maybe you're assisting what is truly dangerous about what's currently popular among evangelicals by making a big deal out of a bygone, really sort of dead theology. I mean, honestly, I've been a Christian for 35 years. I don't think I've ever met a white supremacist who pretends to be a Christian, claims to be a Christian. I know it used to be that way, and particularly in the South, a lot of Christians were, and I wouldn't even say they don't exist, but they're really not a major factor in the evangelical movement. And what it seems to me is a major factor is a lot of sort of left-leaning ideas, social gospel talk, and it's a retooling of old theologies that led a lot of mainstream denominations into liberalism and ultimately total irrelevance. And the ironic thing is it's always sold in the name of relevance. If you want to be relevant, you have to be obsessed with this issue because it's what everybody in the world is talking about right now. And so every time there's an incident where, you know, a policeman shoots a minority, unarmed minority person or whatever, the issue flares up in the secular world in the news, and suddenly that's what Christians are tweeting about and talking about. So that's why books like this are popular. It happens to be the hot-button issue right now.
Okay, but let's just see as best we can if we can figure out how racist evangelical Christianity is. This is very shaky ground to be standing on because I don't know people's hearts. And to me, see, Phil, I come from above the Mason-Dixon line, and the issue of the war of Northern aggression, we called it the Civil War, and it was to blot out slavery.
Yeah.
Now, it's a kind of a different attitude North and South. I get that, and I'm not trying to impugn anybody and everybody, just the opposite, actually. But is it possible that the reason some good men, some leaders in the SBC are kind of singing this same song that there is systemic racism, there needs to be corporate repentance because there is corporate guilt, and they are espousing critical race theory? Is it possible that that is because, for instance, in the Southern Baptist Convention, which was really started in the 1840s because they wanted slavery to remain legal, is it possible that the SBC does have a lot of repenting to do?
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, I understand this, and I need to say I've never been a Southern Baptist, and I don't intend to join the Southern Baptists, and I do think in their history— there was quite, I mean, well, their very founding was based on a systemic racism. So you can't deny that there is such a thing as systemic racism and that it existed in a big way then. But I've been watching the Southern Baptists for 30 years try to recant and denounce their heritage there. I don't know of any Southern Baptists today who would defend slavery. So my question is, how many times do they need to ask forgiveness for that, repent of it, you know, renounce their own history? If it's going to be an ongoing problem, I think the thing to do would be to, you know, close the doors, fold up the Southern Baptist Convention and start a new denomination that doesn't have such a dark heritage. If they can't get past it. But I don't know. I'm not a Southern Baptist, so I can't speak about that.
Yeah, because we've all been thinking about this issue, and like I said, we know folks on the other side of the aisle, and it's like I don't think these are nefarious characters. These aren't heretics trying to tear down the church and to cause a split in the evangelical world. And yet they see this through a completely different filter than you and I do, Phil. And I'm just wondering if it's because of experience that, you know, we have a lot of pre-understandings based on how we grew up, what TV shows we watch, socioeconomic status, skin color, zip code, all of those things can get into us. And I'm just wondering if their understanding of the issue is really colored by their experience, and that's why they're just seeing this thing totally different.
I don't know, because a decade ago, 15 years ago, when Together for the Gospel was started, we were together for the gospel. John MacArthur recently wrote about this and said, so now all of a sudden there's a fracture between me and my black brethren that has to be reconciled again. But what happened? I mean, what happened within the church? What experience caused this? I don't know of any, and it seems to me that it is largely, if not totally, simply a response to and an embracing of the dialogue and the current what's currently topically popular in the secular world. It's just one more example where the church is following the world, but lagging behind by about 10 or 15 years.
Well, I'm wondering about, see, the reason that I'm trying to figure this out, I think there might be a connection here to wokeness. The people get awakened to this, and the call is for conversation. You need to spend more time, white people need to spend more time with their black brothers and sisters, because when you hear their stories, which is how critical race theory builds its worldview based on anecdotes and stories, once you hear those stories, then you'll be woke and you will get it and understand corporate racism. So I, for instance, Matt Chandler, that's what I hear. That's what turned the wheel for him. He spent some time talking to black brothers and sisters, hearing their stories, some unfortunate things happening to them. And he's determined, therefore, based on that, I'm woke. And now I understand that the whole system is racist. So, again, I'm just wondering if people are just seeing this because of their experience and they're not filtering it through the Bible like they should.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. But it's a wrong response for a Christian. You look at something like that and say, yeah, this world is full of injustice. There is racism. There are people who do mean things simply out of racial animus. And that's true of people on both sides of this thing. And we look at it and go, if the conclusion is that it's something about the way society is structured and a restructuring of society is going to fix this problem, that isn't a Christian worldview, because the problem is sin in the hearts of all humanity. It's not just the white people, and it's not just the, you know, minority people, or it's not one ethnicity or the other. And I don't know that it's fair even to conclude that one ethnicity is worse at it than the other, because there's sin on all sides. We're all sinners. And the biblical answer to that is not let's restructure society, because in fact that's been done consistently. It's being done and has been done, and it isn't fixing the problem with the all kinds of legislation. I don't know anybody who would defend racism, slavery, or any of those things these days. Laws have been rewritten to guarantee not only equal opportunity, but in some cases, you know, quota systems that sort of give a leg up to people who have historically been disenfranchised and treated badly. And yet, the hostility from people who feel either that they're being disenfranchised or discriminated against, as well as hostility from people who feel like they're being unjustly accused of being racism, both sides. You get more hostility, I think, now than there was that I can remember in the 70s when I was in high school. It seems to be getting worse rather than better with the restructuring of society.
Yeah, that's my observation, and I don't like it. I don't like what it's causing. When I moved to the South, now people can disagree, but I'm just sharing my particular perspective. I was actually shocked at how well it works here. Working with all kinds of different colors, I just don't remember any of that a decade ago. Now it's we, they, and them, and the unity is just being trashed. Now, let me see, Phil, if I can continue to make my case that the reason some people are seeing this issue differently is because of experience. Our second book is called The Gospel in Color, A Theology of Racial Reconciliation for Kids. So books to help you educate your kids about this subject are being written. The Gospel Coalition did a review of it, and it begins this way. I, the author, grew up in a rural town in the American South where racism was normal, both in overt and covert forms. The N-word was a common white epithet for black people that black people internalized and used as well. Now, see what he's building? This is my experience, and therefore, everybody is guilty of the sin of racism.
Yeah.
I think this is another example to support the reason that some good guys are seeing this so differently is because of experience.
It is. And you know, there are two sides to this. We, as believers, we want to be empathetic with people who hurt, who've had bad experiences and all that.
But who of us doesn't, Phil?
Yeah. Well,
of course. I can't tell you what it was like in the 1940s, but I can tell you today, I just don't know people who are talking smack against different people with different colors of skin. I guess it depends on the circles. All right, here's another line from this review. For almost two decades now, as I've lived in a city and traveled around the country, I've seen that racist ideologies and constructs exist beyond rural communities, albeit in subtle and socially acceptable ways. Okay, that's a sneak attack on, hey, the whole system is racist. You don't know it, but it really is. But once again, argument by anecdote.
Well, that's true. I'm inclined to, I mean, if you read that sentence in a certain light, I'm kind of inclined to agree, though. Having lived both in rural communities and urban communities, I think it is true that sometimes subtle forms of racism are more common in urban environments than they are even these days in rural southern communities.
Okay, paint for me what that would look like.
Well, you know, gang warfare and stuff like that, part of that is... I mean, it doesn't get any more violent than that. And a lot of the conflicts between inner city gangs are basically ethnic groups fighting each other. You've got, you know, Hispanic gangs against Black gangs, Korean gangs.
Agree. That happens in prisons too.
Right.
Okay. But that's, I mean, I don't know what the percentage of the population is that happens to be a member of the Crips or the Bloods or the whatever. That's pretty small, though, isn't it?
Well, I guess your perspective on that would depend on how close you live to it. In South Chicago...
Yeah, that's very true.
In South Chicago, you wouldn't think it's a small thing. So, yeah, I mean, there's no question that aspects of our culture are badly broken. The point of debate I would have with social justice warriors, especially in the evangelical movement, I really don't care what somebody outside of the church thinks or wants to do to try to fix some of the brokenness of our culture. But as Christians, I think, you know, if we don't understand that the proclamation of the gospel is our first calling, our most important duty, and the one thing that actually will result in the change of heart among people who, you know, hate each other, then I think we're way off track. And that's been my concern about so much of the evangelical talk about racial issues and wokeness, is that so much of it, if not the majority of it, just totally omits the gospel or tries to redefine the gospel by saying things like, well, this is a gospel issue, so that everything's a gospel issue now. I mean, if you read some of the websites, you'd think every new movie that comes out, every new television show that's popular, everything that happens in pop culture and everything you see on the news is somehow a crucial gospel issue. And if we don't talk about these things, we're going to become irrelevant. And as I said earlier, you start talking about those things and omit the gospel and you will be irrelevant.
Now, let me read to you, by the way, John MacArthur's sermon on that very subject of individual responsibility as opposed to collective guilt, based on the book of Ezekiel, absolutely da bomb.
Yeah.
We've got it in our archives now, and you can get it at gty.org. By the way, Phil, did you ever tell John MacArthur what I said about his sermon?
I did. I sent him, you actually texted
me. No way.
You texted me a comment about it, and I forwarded that text message to him.
And he immediately hit delete.
No, he responded. He responded right away. He said, Todd who?
I don't even doubt that.
I'm kidding.
Here's a couple of lines. Now you see if you agree with this or not. Again, this is talking about a book called The Gospel in Color. Discrimination is deeply ingrained in the structural fabric of the United States, including many Christian spaces and institutions. Do you believe that statement is true or false?
Well, I think it's debatable, and it's a general statement that really doesn't quantify what it's talking about. So, yes, I would dispute it. Not that those things don't exist, but to suggest that this is what colors evangelical racial relations is, I think, grossly misleading. I've never been in an evangelical church where there were any sorts of policies or practices that were discriminatory. And you know, the church I attend now is...
If there's like laws and rules and handbooks at universities that are racist, well, then you would look at that and go, yeah, that's racist. But what this fellow is arguing is it just shows up in subtle ways. So, for instance, that fellow who wrote that critical article about the Master's Seminary saying it was really white while I was there because we only read like white guys.
Yeah, that's a good example.
It's mostly white theologians that wrote these books.
See, I would never suggest that racism can't manifest itself in subtle ways. It certainly does. And if you're ever on the receiving end of it, then you definitely know what that means. But to single out something like, well, you know, when we studied church history, the only African guys whose theology we read were the, what did he say? He said Athanasius.
Yeah, right. Going back, correct.
That's the proof that there's a sort of deliberate attempt to minimize the contribution of black theologians. I just came from Finland, and I'll tell you, I don't think I've ever, in all of my theological studies, had to read a Finnish theologian. There are some. I mean, Finland is a Lutheran country, so there were certainly some Finnish books. But are they of the same importance as, say, you know, Calvin's Institutes or, I don't know, Augustine's Confessions? Augustine was African.
Right. That, and we happily read him. It's good stuff. But Western civilization has produced most of our contemporary theology books.
Yeah, for Protestants, that's true. I mean, if you were a Eastern Orthodox, you'd probably want to argue that point. But
right.
But for us who are Protestants, if you come to a Protestant seminary, you can expect that you're going to read books that were written by Reformers and Puritans and basically European guys. That's going to be the emphasis. That's not racism. That's where our doctrinal statement points. And if you reject it on those grounds, rather than saying, well, but that's false theology, or, you know, or if you think, as some would, because that's so overwhelmingly European, therefore we have to reject it because it shows a bias in one ethnic direction, that's a faulty way to deal with questions of truth and falsehood.
Another book for your consideration, and I'm reading this from a very prominent Baptist church, which names itself after Bethlehem, but I'm not going to say what the name of the church is. This is the letter that was received by the congregation. On Sunday, your leaders shared reflections with the congregations on their trip to the MLK 50 conference in April. They referenced many valuable resources regarding ethnic harmony. Here are a few that I highly recommend. A book called White Awake by Daniel Hill. It appears, Phil, that this book, along with Divided by Race, are being spread high and low all over Christendom to try to persuade people that social justice should be an issue that the evangelical community really just embraces fully. White Awake, Divided by Race. If a church is using these books to study them, like, these are good resources for us, am I concerned about that church?
Yeah, I don't know White Awake. Is that a secular author? Is it not a Christian?
I don't know about this one. It's written by Daniel Hill.
The other one you named, Divided by Faith, is written by a guy who, you know...
Two unbelievers.
He has a religious background, but he doesn't profess to be a believer in the same gospel you and I would affirm. And So his interpretation of it's a lot of statistics in that book. It's a very interesting book, lots of interesting statistics, but the conclusions he draws, I think, are based on a faulty logic that really permeates a lot of today's discussion about equality and racial equality and gender equality and all of those things, we would affirm the necessity of equal opportunity, right? That everybody should have an equal standing under the law and every opportunity should be open to everyone equally and all of that. But you can't test the fairness or justness of a system by looking at the outcome. Nothing can guarantee equality of outcome. So you can't look at one ethnic group, nationality, gender, or whatever and say, you know, because like they do this with feminism. They say there's a very low percentage, comparatively low percentage of women who seek careers in the STEM, science, technology, economics, and mechanics, I think, STEM. So there's a low percentage of women in those careers. So that proves that women are being discriminated against. Well, does it? Maybe it proves that there's a natural tendency in women to choose different kinds of roles.
Well, there could be all kinds of variables involved in that. Same thing with the inequity of salaries for men and women. There's at least 18 different reasons, and sexism is
right.
One of them.
Yeah.
It's one of them, but it's not the only thing.
The point is, raw statistics don't prove anything. You have to interpret those statistics by a grid that you put on it, your worldview, your expectations, and you have to understand that the statistics alone don't necessarily prove anything. So that's, I think, one of the fallacies behind divided by race. He depends too much on, he thinks that the meaning of some of the statistics he cites is patently obvious, whereas somebody with a biblical worldview ought to interpret some of those statistics in an entirely different way.
Daniel Hill is the author of White Awake. And not only that, many people don't know this. He also sang Can't We Try Just a Little Bit Harder, if I'm not mistaken. It's an IVP book, Phil.
I think it's a different Dan Hill, but yeah.
I know that.
All right. Hey, by the way, before we get too far away from it, the second book you named, the one that was written for children, you didn't say who published
yes.
that, and I'm curious about that.
Oh, Phil, I've thrown it near the garbage can. I can't reach it from here.
No, pick it up. No, I mean, you don't have to do it right now, but later, get it and send it to me.
Oh, no.
I'm interested.
Oh, no. You just talk for a few seconds, and I'll go get it.
Should I talk about my deep
I'm not kidding.
Appreciation for Todd and how goofy he is? And by the way,
right.
I sat in...
Hold on.
I'm still talking.
I'm back.
I sat in Todd's office for a couple of hours the other day, and everything he finished with, he threw at the trash can, and I think he only hit it twice. So you're not a real good shot.
That's because I only threw two things, really.
No.
All right, The Gospel in Color is the name of the book. Patrol, a Patrol original book, P-E-T-R-O-L. Sorry, it's a little smudgy here.
Petrol.
P-A-T-R-O-L. Sorry, a
Patrol original
book.
Petrol.
Well, I think actually petrol might be a better thing to use on this book, but that's just me. So a Patrol original book.
Well,
that do anything for you, Phil?
No, but if you send it to me, I'm actually interested in that one. I'd like to thumb through that and see where they're going.
Mm-hmm. So you made me get out of my chair and crawl around in the garbage, and you don't care. All right. That's okay. Phil, I'm here to serve. I want to ask you one last thing. This was basically from that list of books that are being studied by this church. And they also recommended a keynote session from MLK 50. And I just want you to comment on the title of this, because we hear this a lot. The most segregated hour in America, Phil, is it?
Well, in my judgment, no. I mean, segregation, the word itself, seems to imply a sort of forced division, like you're not allowed to come to this church if you're of a different race. And there was some of that just not long ago. I read a story, I think just today or yesterday, I can't remember if it was even this morning, but about a person who was talking about it growing up in the South, where this apparently a Baptist church actually took a vote. Do they want to allow black people? And they voted no. And that kind of thing is just absolutely deplorable. And since there are still lots of people alive who suffered through that kind of forced segregation, I understand their sort of emotional reaction to that, strong emotional reaction, I would too. I do too. But to suggest that that kind of thing is still going on, my response is show me, because you show me, I'll go and preach to those people myself and rebuke them for that sort of attitude. I just have never encountered a church, in my experience as a Christian. I came to Christ early in the 70s, and in all that time, I don't think I've ever even known about a church, and there may be some, there probably are some, where somewhere within that time span, purposely segregated themselves. I just don't see that happening. But what are we to do? Are we going to like force integration like they did in the public schools and forbid people to go to this church that is in their neighborhood or they chose because it's not ethnically diverse enough? That doesn't seem to me to be a solution, really, to anything.
Well, and it's going to change missiology, and it's going to change church planting.
Oh, it already has.
Because this whole idea of making sure that every congregation is salt and pepper, it would be, to me, it's like saying, okay, we do not have enough left-handed people in this congregation.
Yeah.
Go find some left-handed people to bring into this. You go, what are you talking about?
The funny thing, Todd, is this is an example of how the pendulum swings both ways, because when the seeker-sensitive church movement was at its peak and you had, you know, Willow Creek on the West Coast and, Willow Creek is in Chicago and Saddleback on the West Coast, both of them saying the same things that, you know, if you really want a big, successful church like ours, you need to aim for the same economic class and age group and all of that. And they were discriminating, and I think some of them still do discriminate against old people and maybe even people of different races. I don't know, but they wanted a sort of similarity between all the people in their group because their view was that's what draws people. They want to feel like they're in the midst of people who are just like them. And so there was a purposeful kind of segregation. It wasn't necessarily racially based, but they deliberately segregated those churches. And now we're being told that, you know, diversity is the thing. It's got to be all diverse. And it seems to me that to try to manipulate that either way is contrary to what we know. Jesus said, I will build my church. And whoever he brings, it seems to me, ought to be welcome. Anyone who's saved is welcome in our church.
Exactly. Phil, it used to be, though, that when somebody, if let's say a congregation, they lived in any sort of urban setting, and they saw that there was a people group that was being unreached, they would never say, look, we need to get more of those people in here because of their skin color. Instead, they would say, let's go start a church plant in the midst of those people and reach them in their community, as opposed to, I guess, having them commute out to the suburbs so that they can be a part of a white church because the church is determined it needs more black people. So it seems to me the church plant model used to be, let's go plant a church there and reach those folks. Now it's, no, let's drive in there, I guess, and somehow persuade them to come to our really white church out in the suburbs. I just don't see it being a tenable model. Yeah.
Right. Although, in fairness, though, Todd, you can see why someone looking at that would say, well, what are they saying? Look, we don't want those people from that lower class community in our upper class, middle class church. If that's what's motivating them to start a separate church rather than welcoming people into their fellowship,
that's just wrong.
That's bad, too. So, either way, you've got the potential. But, you know, I was about to say, if you're going to insist, no, we have to meet certain quotas, then you're going to slip into a different kind of racism. It's still racism, where you're paying more attention to the color of a person's skin or his ethnic background than you are to the question of, you know, is he truly one with Christ and therefore one with this fellowship? Are we just trying to populate our church with a certain demographic, or are we actually preaching the gospel?
Well, there's a name for that.
What is the name of it?
It sounds to me like you just described affirmative action.
Yeah, that's what you would have to adopt, a kind of affirmative action or a quota system, if you're going to think that it's absolutely vital to have a representative proportion of people that reflects, say, our city.
And you know what, Phil? I've always thought a church really should reflect the makeup of the local population, not 10 miles away, but, you know, in zip codes that surround that church. I do think that the church should, if it's just out preaching the gospel, they've come pretty close to reflecting the community that it actually exists in. But this is different than that. It's insisting.
Yeah, although, what if it doesn't? What if it doesn't perfectly? Because we live in a commuter society right now and all of that. It seems to me that the only criteria is who is the Lord adding to his church? That's really all I care about. Once I start to obsess about whether we have enough people from this ethnic group or that, and maybe it's easier for me to talk about these things because Grace Church is just so ethnically diverse, and so is Los Angeles. So we minister in the midst of, in fact, the actual neighborhood where Grace Church is about three blocks away from the largest Buddhist temple in the Western Hemisphere. It's a Thai temple, and because of the policies that they follow, if you were a Thai Buddhist devoted to your religion, you coming into L.A., you would want the priest to bless whatever house you choose. And so the priests in that temple tend to bless the houses in the community. So it's a very heavily weighted towards Thai Buddhist population. And so our church has a pretty strong outreach to people from that community and a lot of Thai people in our church. But we also have a lot of pretty much every ethnic group, a lot of Armenians. So I don't know what that means. It just means that the Lord is saving people, and Scripture tells us this, from every tongue and tribe and nation. And I'm glad for that.
Well, but here's where I get a little bit suspicious, though, too, of the admonitions that we're receiving that the Sunday morning church hour is the most segregated hour in America. Phil, I don't like using this term. I actually understand this now, why this is just it's a terrible term, but to just help the conversation. The black church, for instance, if you look at a lot of the urban churches, a lot of the prosperity churches to boot, it's very black. And I wonder, are any of these folks who are trying to encourage white congregations to become more mixed, are they doing the same thing with black congregations?
Well, they're clearly not, because the unsavory racist attitudes that would require to do that are just become too obvious.
So it works with one group of people, it doesn't work with the other. Well, Phil, the conversation continues.
Philosophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?